Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. I'm Alan Wilson, the host of the podcast, and my guest on this episode is Todd Balzinger. Todd is the author of Canoeing the Mountains and Tempered Resilience. He's been on the podcast a couple of times before, and today we're talking about a collection of four new short books that he's been working on. They make up the Practicing Change collection, and they'll be available in August. The books are called How Not to Waste a Crisis, The Mission Always Wins, Leading Through Resistance, and Invest in Transformation. Enjoy the podcast. Todd, welcome back. I think it was maybe about 3 years ago that you were on the podcast before.
I think so, Alan. It was nice to see you again.
Yeah, good. And we chatted the last time about a couple of your books, with the Canoe in the Mountains and then Tempered Resilience. Those are books that I've used. I mean, you'd be interested to know this. I've used those in mentoring conversations and stimulating lots of good discussion. So thank you for those. And here we go, about to not just one new book, but actually four new books that are on their way over the summer. So I thought what we could do maybe before we really get underway is a quick reminder of Canoeing the Mountains and Tempered Resilience. Yeah. Some people will have read that, and because they've read it, they're thinking, oh, it's great, what's coming next? Others, it'd probably be good to sketch the background, because the background is quite important for what's coming in the summer, isn't it?
Yeah. So Canoeing the Mountains, Alan, as you know, is about how to lead when you don't have a map, basically, when your old best practices don't work, when the things that have been tried and true begin to fail you, when what got you here won't take you to where you need to go. And you learn, and it develops the theory of adaptive leadership. And when I said develops it, because I didn't discover it, that's Raul Heifetz and Marty Linsky out of Harvard. They came up with adaptive leadership. And what I've done to it is basically applied that with a missional theology and a nod to systems theory, because the way churches and particularly work are almost more like a family system, to say, how do you take a community forward when all the things that you cherish and things in the past are not quite working the way they used to? And that requires a different kind of leadership, adaptive leadership, that really begins when someone looks you in the eye and asks you, so what do you think we should do? And you have to answer, I don't know, but I know we got to keep going. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Canoeing the Mountains is about adaptive leadership. And Tempered Resilience was about the number one problem in adaptive leadership, which is that your own people begin to sabotage the thing they said they wanted. And that was a big insight that we learned when we started talking about adaptive leadership, was the big challenge, and particularly the more kind of soul-sucking challenge of most faith leaders, isn't the challenges of the world out there that's changing. It's the resistance of our own people in the church when we ask them to be transformed to meet the challenges of the world out there. And so Tempered Resilience is about the formation needed for leaders to face that kind of sabotage.
Yeah. And in terms of the new books, so we'll get to a little bit of a synopsis of them in a moment. Having had the opportunity to read those ahead of time, I think you draw particularly on the ideas of canoeing the mountains. It's almost like saying, okay, let's break down this whole piece of canoeing the mountains, leading off the map. Let's break that down into four component areas. Is that a fair summary? Yeah.
When I say to people, the way I talk about this when I'm asked, why'd you write the four books, is I say, these are the four big mistakes that really good leaders make when they're trying to lead change. Good leaders, I mean, good people who are trustworthy and wise and faithful and competent, they tend to fall into one of these four mistakes. And it's because they're good leaders who've had some faithfulness and some success and some blessing of God to their ministries. And so what we did is we took the work that my consulting company and my team of coaches have done, and we looked at that work and we said, here are the things that we're seeing where people are stumbling. And we just started looking at those things particularly.
Okay. And I guess in some ways, we'll get to the titles of the book in a moment, the books in a moment, but in some ways it seems to me the subtitles, some of which I think are quite provocative. The subtitles are probably, this is getting at the mistakes that people are making.
right?
Yeah, Alan, you're very perceptive. The subtitles were all of my titles. the other titles are what the publisher said. You know, those subtitles are a little harsh.
Oh, would you originally have gone with those subtitles as titles of the books?
Yeah, those were my titles. Right? I literally had...
It would have sold a lot anyway.
Well, and my thought about it was at the time I was really like, if you've been in a position where you're facing something really hard and you come to someone and say, give me some help, what do I need to do? A lot of times they look at you and they go, it's not what you're doing. It's not what you're not doing. It's that you keep doing this thing that's not working. So quit this, quit doing that. And that's what these books are. There's kind of four of those, quit doing that.
So quit trying harder, quit appeasing the stakeholders, quit pushing back, and quit relying on trust. Yeah, I think strikes me particularly number two and number four. Those are quite provocative. You know, I kind of looked at number two and I thought, wait, hang on a minute here. And the title is "The Mission Always Wins," and quit appeasing the stakeholders. I said, is it as simple as that? And to be fair, when I read the book, I thought, oh no, he's much more nuanced than just that. But those are the four traps then that people fall into. Can we back off just for a second? I want to come back on the adaptive leadership thing. You've talked about it as leading off the map. And you know, you've drawn a lot on Ronald Heifetz, Marty Linsky, and in fact Marty Linsky has written a foreword to each of the four books. I think it's the same one, isn't it? But so they contrast that with technical change and adaptive change. Just for anybody not familiar with those terms, can you just say a little bit?
Yeah, it's actually a really helpful way of thinking about it. And it's one of the themes in the first book about How Not to Waste a Crisis, which is about quit trying harder, is that whenever you're facing a problem, the first thing you have to do is actually diagnose the kind of problem it is. And so they do this very simple matrix that is really helpful. But they said the first set of problems are problems that you have the expertise to solve. It doesn't mean they're easy. It doesn't mean they're simple, you know, but a technical problem is one an expert can solve. So I said that when my father, who's 82 years old, had a heart valve transplant during COVID, he went to a guy who was an expert at doing heart valve transplants. And thank God he did, because my father's still alive, right? Whenever I'm in an airplane, I want someone who can land a plane, especially in turbulence, right? A technical problem is a problem an expert can solve. And many of us as leaders become experts at certain things, like how to exegete difficult passages of scripture, how to think ethically about complicated issues, how to work out the church polity that was written in the 1600s for the 21st century. Those are complicated issues. Well, you can be trained to do it. I said, you know, I work at a seminary. We train people how to preach on the Trinity without committing heresy.
Yes.
Right? No eggs or water or shamrocks or those things that we all love that are actually heresies. We teach people how to do that. An adaptive challenge is when you don't have the expertise or when your old best practices, your old expertise doesn't work anymore. And that's when you have to develop adaptive leadership, which is about learning to shift values, attitudes, and behaviors. Mm-hmm. And that shifting is an act of discernment and an act of coming together around the challenge in a new way where you have to experiment your way forward because you don't have a best practice. So you have to lead in a really different way.
It's a higher risk form of change, isn't it? Then because a technical challenge, say you're the pastor of the church, people have brought you in to do certain things. You meet a technical challenge because you've got the skills to do it and everybody applauds. But an adaptive change, adaptive leadership, you're risking, well, that's where we'll get with some of the books, isn't it? But there's a risk of opposition, a risk of loss of trust and all of those kinds of things. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. In adaptive leadership, one of the key parts is that it starts with learning. You have to start with saying, I don't know. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to learn our way forward. Mm-hmm. But in adaptive leadership, it's always about loss. Mm-hmm. You said Marty Linsky wrote the foreword to these books. I got to know him a bit through the prior to writing them. And I asked him once, I said, Marty, what do you think is the most important thing about adaptive leadership? that I could make sure I underline when I work with leaders. And he said, it's always about loss.
It's always about loss.
It's always yep. about loss. You're letting mm-hmm. something go, and usually something dear to people. Mm-hmm.
And that's where the point comes then, that the argument that people don't resist change per se, but they resist loss.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, exactly. And I guess that feeds into your tempered resilience, because people are resisting loss. They're not setting out because they're bad people who want to sabotage you, but they're feeling the pain of the loss.
Yes, exactly. I always say, when we talk about sabotage, we say sabotage is not the bad things that evil people do. Mm. It is the human things that anxious people do.
Yeah, human things that anxious people
are
do. Yeah.
Fearful about loss. Very human is to stop the transformation process. It's to stop the change. Mm-hmm. And that's usually what makes it worse.
Mm. From a very practical level, why four books and not just one bigger one?
Yeah.
With four sections.
I love this. Well, so it's a very interesting conversation I've had with my publisher. They had this idea they wanted me to do. And I said, well, I got a different idea. And they wanted to do some small books, is what they wanted to do. I said, well, if I'm going to do some small books, I want to do them this way. And at first they went, we're not sure we want you to do quite that much. And so my agent, who is amazing, said, why don't you write one of them? Why don't you just show them instead of, you know, try to convince them? So I wrote the first one. And they came back and went, oh, we'll take four. And the reason was just so great. And because I love my publisher and I love the people I get to work with. The reason why is that I wanted a book that literally was short enough. The example I used was, if a nonprofit executive got on a plane in Los Angeles and they were going to fly to Houston, Texas, which is about a 3-hour flight, they could read the book in the 3 hours. And that they could literally be done with the book and they could go, oh, I'm going to order 10 copies of this for my team. And we're going to all read this on Wednesday. Like we can jump into it quickly.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted them about. So I made them very focused, and the formats are very similar.
Yes.
And it really is about start with the self-reflection about the one area you're struggling with the most mm-hmm. and beginning to jump in on that.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I said, it's really taking the concepts of canoeing the mountains and breaking them down then. And I think, I mean, I absolutely take your point on the executive who's flying on a 3-hour flight and, you know, everybody's going to read the book on Wednesday. It is that they are that accessible. I think they're going to be a great resource for leadership teams to sit down and think things through. You've the way you've broken stuff down is very, very clear, and it's become very accessible. I mean, basically you do follow the same pattern. There's always a case study. Always sort of left hanging at the beginning, and then they all live happily ever after at the end after you've taken us through the process. But then
a movie, about 3 hours to solve the problem.
But then you've got, I mean, basically there's sort of a structure where there's what you call an old mindset. So it's a bit like those subtitles of the book that we mentioned earlier. There's a new skill set, which is usually a 3-part thing. I think always a 3-part thing. Mm-hmm. And then what you call an adaptive reset that needs to be put in place. So give us the four actual titles then. We'll do it the other way around. We'll start with your subtitle thing, the negative bit. Mm-hmm. It gets everybody. What? And then give us the title, and then we'll start to dig into some of the themes.
So these are the four big mistakes that good leaders make. I mean, these are good leaders. I was just last week with a group of eight leaders, all remarkable people, all just thoughtful, engaged, very different contexts. We just spent 2 deep days going through these together. The first one is called quit trying harder. Because the first mistake that really good leaders make is thinking they can outwork every problem. I just put my head down, work hard enough, preach a good enough sermon series, organize a good org chart, get a good team, figure out the problems, create a good strategic plan. We're going to solve every problem. And it's because most of us have in our minds a little voice. I said, it's like your parents or your old coach or somebody who says, don't just stand there, do something. And so we get up in the middle of the night and we start doing stuff. And what we have to teach people actually is not to do something, but to to stand there for a moment and see the problem, see the shift before you solve the problem.
Right.
And so what we teach people is the steps of getting on the balcony, learning to identify the shift, learning then to, from there, experiment your way forward. And what's interesting about what we did is we looked at the way good leaders and really adults change most, which isn't just changing your mind. It's actually changing your behaviors so that your mind now has a new way of thinking of the problem. And that's what it leads us to. So we say that the end result, instead of trying really hard, what you should get good at is experimenting. Yeah. So we have a little phrase, don't try to predict the future, do it. Don't try to predict how to solve it. It's don't predict, prototype.
Yeah.
With a small, safe set of experiments that you'll learn from over and over and over again. And the quicker you learn, the quicker you'll develop your way through the problem.
Yeah. And the title of that one is How Not to Waste a Crisis. Yeah, there's a thing. There's a thing too that you just drop the this phrase in, and people who've read other stuff around this area will be familiar with it. But the balcony, there's an image there that is drawn from the dance floor, and it's the contrast between the dance floor and the balcony. Just sort of spell that out for us a little bit.
Yeah. Thank you, Alan. It's probably the most central idea in four books, which is that we're all. If you think about it, like being in the middle of a dance floor. And I sometimes say, if you were ever asked to chaperone a group of teenagers on a dance floor, right? You know, it's loud and noisy and they're bumping into each other and it smells like body spray. And you're like trying to figure out how to, it's just overwhelming. And that most of the time when we're leading, we're down on the dance floor and we're overwhelmed. And what you have to do is develop a discipline of what Heifetz and Linsky call getting up on the balcony, which is to be able to see the patterns, see the structures, see the deeper issues that are at play so that you're not just chasing it around the dance floor. So even in the book, we create what we call balcony sessions, yes, which are sets of deep reflective discussions after every single section, including at the end of the book, a team balcony session, because the most important skill is actually getting off the dance floor and learning to see the shift before you solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Okay, the second one is again the subtitle. This is probably the one that kind of raised my eyebrows a little bit. Quit appeasing stakeholders. I know the word appeasing is a sort of fairly negative word, but stakeholders. I mean, you got your colleagues, you've got the people who are paying for this thing, all of that. I mean, do you not want to keep them on board?
Yeah. So the problem we have is that most of us as good leaders are really good at pleasing stakeholders. But after a while, you go from pleasing to appeasing. Mm. Where pretty soon what you're doing is you're measuring your success on how happy everybody is with you. And the hard part about making really hard adaptive challenges is you can't think win-win. Almost all of us, I said, there's a great book by Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And I said, every leader I know, that was the first leadership book they were given because they probably didn't organize something really well. They weren't very effective. And somebody handed them that book. And the thing everybody remembers from that book, which I love, is think win-win. And I always say that if you can solve a problem with a win-win solution, then it's probably a technical problem. It just takes some maturity and some planning and some thoughtfulness. But the hardest decisions that we have to face are not win-win decisions. They're a hard decision that is going to require someone to experience that loss we talked about.
Yeah.
And the hard part is when that loss is to somebody that is important to you, like the old guard who kept this church alive for the difficult years, or the donors, or yourself, or your team. And so what we talk about here is the only thing that wins every argument is your mission.
Right.
Your mission wins. Not your leaders, not you, not your donors, not the old guard, not the new people, not the person who's complaining the loudest or the person who's been here the longest. The mission wins. Mm-hmm. And getting really clear on what is our purpose, what is our mission, how can we all stack hands on that and agree to that and then move forward is a really important skill set.
Okay. And that one's called The Mission Always Wins. There's a couple of points on that one that I want to come back on a little later on. So we'll hold those thoughts. The third mistake then is pushing back. So quit pushing back, and you call this leading through resistance. So pushing back when you're talking about change, people are resisting it. They're pushing back against you. Temptation is that you just try to push harder.
Yeah. So this is the, in one sense, this is the other side to the appeasing stakeholders. There's some of us who are so committed to our ideas and to our concepts and to our big thing, our plans, that we just get stubborn. And we think that a good hallmark of a leader is just being determined and stubborn. So when someone pushes back on you, you kind of, you know, stiffen your back and you like push back on them, and you're going to prove I'm the boss. And it's my idea. We're going to do it my way. Or this is the smartest idea, or you win the idea with an argument. What we've learned is the best ideas elicit resistance, because you're actually asking people to engage in something and they need a bit of time to adapt to it. So what you learn to do is, instead of keep pushing back on people, what we teach them is how to pull them by, how to move along.
How to pull them by, haul them by, did you say? Yeah.
Pull them by. Like, sorry, pull them by. Think of it as one of the examples I use in the book is the martial arts of jujitsu, which is literally about instead of trying to overcome your enemy or get away from your enemy, you actually get close to your enemy and you pull them by and use their strength to pull them in the direction you want to go. And what this is really about is teaching people how to use emotional intelligence and empathy to actually get people to come join with you in the movement.
Yeah, you use the word attunement in that. Attunement accelerates change is how you describe the mindset there. Okay, well, the fourth one then, and again, this is a provocative one that some people are going to say, what's he on about here? Quit relying on trust. And someone's going to say, well, but is trust not the currency of leadership?
Yeah. Actually, this is the most provocative or without question. Mm-hmm. And the reason is this. There is no transformation without trust. Mm-hmm. There is just no transformation without trust. If you lose trust, no one's going to follow you anywhere. But trust is not transformation. Mm-hmm. It's like having a big bank account when you really want to do a building project. You're going to have to invest that bank account into that building project. Mm-hmm. And what we have to learn how to do is be people who are completely trustworthy in every way we possibly can be. And we'll learn how to use that trust and utilize that trust in an appropriate and character-filled way that will bring transformation. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, I would say that if you think of it, good managers build trust. And I think any of us, good leaders, build trust. Good people of good character. But it's not just a matter of having people like you and trust you. They've got to be willing to actually follow you where they're even resisting going. Mm-hmm. And that's going to require them to actually sometimes become disappointed in you because they don't like the direction. And to be honest, this is the place where you see Jesus a lot with his disciples. Like, he's telling them things and they're like, what are you doing talking to that woman by the well? Mm-hmm. What are you doing sending away the crowds? What are you doing? Like, they have to trust him, even though they haven't quite come to the place where they see the transformation that he's bringing in their own.
Yeah. And the idea, I mean, the title of that one is Invest in Transformation. So the idea then is that it's not enough for a leader simply to accumulate trust and then bask in the status that brings. Yes. They have to be prepared to invest that trust in doing the work of transformation. And that, I guess, runs a risk, because some people might decide, don't like where you're going, don't trust you anymore.
Oh, for people, so for so many leaders, in a world where we don't trust our leaders, when we find leaders who are really trustworthy and leaders are in a good environment, everybody just wants the status quo. Let's just keep this going. This is really good. So, oh my gosh, what can we do so that you can be here the rest of your ministry and that we can be fine? The problem is, after a while, that becomes a status quo that then begins to decline. You have to be willing to keep moving toward transformation. And that's, of course, going to require loss. And when you ask people to take on a loss, trust goes down a bit.
Yeah. Let's dig into some of the points. And there's a number of things that I you know, I've made a little note of just in thinking about the books. And this idea of loss, and I think we're revisiting something we talked about a few minutes ago. It's not change that people resist, but loss. Sort of spell that out a little bit.
Yeah, so the imagery that I often say is very often if you ask people, you know, so like I work with church people like you, so what is the purpose of this consultation? Why do we bring you in? And they'll say stuff like, we just don't want to lose our church. Right? I'll say, okay, well, here's the thing I need you to know. Paul's churches are all dead. Every church.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But we're here. We're here as people of faith. So probably the goal isn't just the institution or the church or the building. It's not the wineskin, it's the wine. And it's not even just this little bit of wine. It's the ability to grow grapes and produce harvests and see that passed down through the generation. So it might require loss. You might have to actually, the thing you love the most might have to be put on the back burner or might have to be shut down completely. It might have to be recycled into something else. That we all resist. We just do. I mean, yeah. As humans, we do. And so taking people through loss is critical. And for most of us as ministers, we were taught how to do that with individuals. Like, how do you help people face death? Or how do you help them face the death of a loved one? We weren't taught how to do that with communities, mm-hmm. or particularly with communities who are missional organizations. We weren't taught how to do that.
Mm. And you can't change without loss.
No.
Yeah.
It's the deep, deep disappointment that we wish we could. And unconsciously, we tend to want our leaders, we tend to pick leaders who will tell us that we don't have to face loss. Mm-hmm. Like we want the person who says, oh, don't worry, I can fix it. I'll get it for you. Mm-hmm. And the answer to it usually is that's a mistake. That's usually a technical fix for a deeper adaptive challenge that is going to require transformation. And that transformation is going to come from loss.
There's an amazing quote. I think it's from Heifetz and Linsky that says that leadership is the art of disappointing your people at a rate at which they can absorb it. I know you like that quote. I like it as well. Some people think it's just a far too cynical, jaded view of leadership. But it is reality, isn't it? It's a funny way to put it.
Well, it's really interesting. Everybody I know who's ever been in leadership, they're the people who don't think it's cynical at all. They're like, that's exactly what I'm doing. when I quote that, it was a quip that Marty Linsky himself said in an article. When I quote that, people literally nod and say, that is exactly, that's what I didn't know was happening when I took on this responsibility. Like the only way to move people forward is I would end up having to disappoint them. And disappoint them wisely and well, and that gives people the room to grow and be transformed.
Yeah. Great. Let's talk a little bit about mission. So the mission always wins. And in that, you talk about mission statements, and there's a couple of interesting things that you say about that. One is, it's a good slogan, a mission statement. It's not, I think, what did you say? A mission statement is not a motto for a T-shirt.
It's a tool, it's a tool, not a T-shirt.
A tool, not a T-shirt. That's it. Yeah. So it's a mission statement is not simply a motto. And it's very easy for people to try to find a catchy motto, isn't it? But you advocate having mission statements that come to only 8 words.
This isn't my own idea.
Okay.
There was this nonprofit funding group called the Milagro Foundation, and I talk about it in Canoeing the Mountains. But in the book here, I actually lay out the process of having done this now with well over 100 organizations, which is where you make people have a conversation that's very, very clear. So I said, your mission statement is the point of your mission statement is to help you make decisions. That's what it's about. How do we decide? What do we do? And I said, when you think decision, I want you to hear the word incision. What are you going to have to cut away? What are you going to have to decide not to do? So what you want is a tool that's very sharp, because you want to cut something very finely and with as least amount of tearing and pain as possible. It's going to be painful, but you want the least amount of pain. So you do that by getting what they talk about is an 8-word mission statement, verb, target, impact. That's
verb,
it.
Verb, target, impact. Okay, give me an example.
So my little company, AE Sloan Leadership, I sometimes say that we've done it so much, we got it down to 7 words. So it's help faith leaders thrive as change leaders. Hmm. That's it. Help faith leaders thrive as change leaders. So when people ask us, so what does that mean? Well, our target is where you start. Our target is faith leaders. It's not churches. It's not universities. It's not schools. It's not businesses. It's anybody of faith leading anything where they want to bring their faith to bear on what they're being called to do. Like, sometimes that's people in the public sector. Sometimes that's people in business. A lot of times it's church leaders or universities or nonprofits. So we faith leaders is who we focus on. Doesn't mean we only work with faith leaders, but it's the center of our target. So if a person comes to me and they say, look, I'm not a person of faith, but I like your leadership, I'll say, then you'll probably need to talk about the values, because that's where we start. We start with the most important values. That's what faith leaders bring. So what do you want? What is our impact? We want them to thrive as change leaders. And every word there is really important. We can't guarantee you that you're going to be able to bring change, because some organizations just resist it and they won't. And you can't make somebody else do something. You can't make somebody be transformed. Mm-hmm. But we can help you thrive as a leader, especially if you'll focus on leading through change. And then we came back to the verb. And I have to tell you, Alan, the verb we came to was disappointing to me. We help. That's what we do. We help people. And people are like, well, why is that disappointing? Because I like more robust verbs. I want to be catalyzing or inspiring or equipping or, you know, nope, we help. That's what we do. We help, and faith leaders thrive as change leaders. And what it helps us to do with that statement is it gets us really clear on all the things we won't do. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So a leader comes to us and says, our church is in the middle of conflict. Will you help us? No, we'll help you when you're ready to bring change after the conflict. Oh, we're in the middle of looking for a new leader. Would you help us with a search? Nope. After you find the person, you have someone who does search for you really well, we'll work with them when they want to bring change. Oh, will you help us with a building project? No, we'll help you with the mission, the strategy that will get you there.
Yeah.
Right? What it did for us is it got us very clear on the center of our target. And therefore, we can then make decisions about how we can thrive through them. And the mission makes the difference.
Mm.
It's not me coming in. Many times my staff will say to me, I'll come in with an idea. We should try this. And they'll literally say, Todd, we help faith leaders thrive as change leaders. Okay, the mission wins. Not Todd. Not even the fact that I'm the owner of the company. Like, the mission wins.
Yeah. Do you find that do you find there are many organizations that really struggle to get it down to that? I guess that's part of what your job is, isn't it? But are there lots of people that really struggle to get it as concise as that?
Yeah, the exercise is what matters, and the book gives you some techniques. In our company, we spend whole days with people on this, because what we always want to do is create a mission statement that everybody who's already here can agree to.
Yeah.
We're afraid of the pain. Mm-hmm. I mean, there will come casualties. I worked with one group where they literally said, you know, if we decide that this is where God is leading us, we're going to do this, then we're going to have some people wearing a different uniform next year. You know, people are going to wear a different kit. They're going to wear a different jersey. They're going to leave, in other words. Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. That's what happens.
Mm-hmm. There's a question I'm going to ask, maybe ask this later on, because I want to ask you stuff about values and so on as well. Let me come back to the values one. But just on that, so people, the pain of people leaving, how do you balance keeping the mission the main thing? So the mission always wins. But especially as Christians, the care for those who maybe get hurt along the way. You know, is there something you can do to, if they're not going to be able to commit to the mission or the change, is there still a responsibility, something that you need to do to care for them?
It's the right question, and I really appreciate it. This is where we talk a lot about the notion of competing values. Mm. And very oftentimes when leaders talk about competing values, they set up a kind of a bad straw man illustration. Like, are we going to be consumerists? You know, are we we going to be committed to Jesus? Yeah. No, that's not the painful one. The painful one is, are we going to live out this mission that might cause some of our people who we love to not be with us anymore? Mm. That's painful. So I always said, so one of the things we teach in that book is you have to pay attention to casualties. Mm-hmm. It's going to be hard. And any one of us who's ever been in a healthy organization has either helped people leave who were casualties or have been one. I mean, I have been casualties. I had to self-select out of a role once I realized what was next for the organization, that they needed a different leader than me. Mm-hmm. And I loved the place and loved it dearly and loved my job and loved my boss. And finally, when I looked at him and said, what you need is this person, me. She's on my team. She's great. She's better at this than I am. You need her. And we both agreed and I stepped out. And that's a casualty. So the way we treat the people who we care for, because it's in the words of my friend Scott Cuomo, these people have all been entrusted to our care. The way we care for those people is really important. But the mission. I mean, yeah, even you see this with Jesus.
Yes.
Like he would say, look, right now I'm called to the lost sheep of Israel. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to attend to you. Mm-hmm. Another day, after the Holy Spirit comes, it's going to be out going to all the world. But right now, this is our mission. And it's disappointing to people.
Yeah. Yeah. You've talked about values a couple of times, once in relation to mission, but also this idea of competing values. And there's a fascinating bit that you talk about, and I think it's very much on target, where you talk about the difference between aspirational values and actual values. And I think, I don't know what your sense is, but my sense would be that it's very easy for anybody, and you kind of do a bit of an exaggerated example of this in a dialogue and so on, but it's very easy for any organization, for a church, to put up a bunch of values, because these are things that are good things that we really ought to value. But in reality, when you breathe the air of the place, it's just not what's happening. So talk about those two things. How do you get from what your actual values are? How do you begin to replace maybe values that are inadequate or are holding you back, or maybe they're negative? How do you get from that to the aspirational becomes actual?
So the key thought behind adaptive leadership is that organizations are living organisms, that they are just a living organism that needs to adapt to a changing environment to thrive. And that living organism, if you ask it, you realize the values are its DNA. That's what makes it unique. So understanding and affirming the uniqueness of the DNA is to actually take an honest, loving look at who we really are, and then say all change happens from there. Like that's where, like, good, really thriving, good, health change is healthy adaptation of your core DNA. So it means stuff like, if you just think about it as a human being, one of the things I'm now of the age where my doctor wants me to pay attention to, what are the kinds of things that your family, diseases that your family had? Did you have a family of heart disease? We had diabetes. My father has neuropathy. My grandfather died of a heart attack. So I'm 60. So one of the things I have to do is take seriously that my family DNA could be deadly to me. So it doesn't mean that I disown my family and pretend I'm not. Mm. It means that I pay attention to it. And then I eat differently than my grandfather, who died at 60. And I exercise more. And I pay attention to things like what made my father, who's lived into his 80s, but who has become almost an invalid. So I become very aware that if you look at your core DNA and who you actually are, and then you can make decisions about what it means to be a healthy version of that, it keeps us in the organizational world from trying to be something we're not. Like, I'm a Presbyterian, right? One of the most ridiculous things is when Presbyterians think, well, what we have to do is just get rid of the name Presbyterian and call ourselves something like the Flood. And we try to do trendy ideas instead of going, so what is the uniqueness of our faith and uniqueness of this community? And how can we adapt this to a changing world so that it can thrive? And where this is really becomes pretty hard for most leaders is it means that your ability to cast a vision and challenge people prophetically and talk about what we should be, though that's a great gift, it's not nearly as important as naming what we actually are. And then helping the group move from there. And many of our value statements are nothing more than a list of what we should be or ought to be or wish we were. And that's a little bit like me wishing I was 6 inches taller. Like it's just not going to do me as good. If I had the same weight at 6 inches taller,
it'd be great.
Right.
Yeah, but there's a question then that comes to mind on that. If the values are the DNA of a culture and you can't change DNA, there must come a time when what's external to an organization or a church or whatever has changed so much that there are some organizations and their DNA means that they are no longer capable of having a significant purpose in that context. Is that a fair conclusion? And do you just have to shut the thing down?
Well, it's two things. One is you can change DNA, actually. The way you change DNA is you birth something new, right? So I think, I have a daughter who has a husband, and someday, God willing, I might have grandchildren. Yeah. They'll have some of my DNA in them, but they're also going to have a whole other family. they'll have my Italian DNA, and they'll have my son-in-law's Hungarian DNA, and they'll be a whole different, wonderful set of human beings. But you can also the way you think about this is there's certain in organizations, you think about values, some of the values we're going to reaffirm. We're going to say, no matter what, we're not going to lose this. And some of our churches, they've lost some core pieces of their DNA. And they've lost things that made them vibrant at one time. They need to either recover that or get that back. But others have said, there's things that we have to get rid of. So in the United States, we're having a lot of conversations around race. And there are a number of denominations that were founded on, frankly, racist and discriminatory values. And we've had to go back and say, you know what? That's part of your DNA that you have to own. But the reason why the church grew at one time is because it grew in a context where those ideas were valuable. And if you want to be fruitful in this day, you might need to repent. You might need to let that go and move forward. I'll give you a more positive example. I work with a group of folks who are Swedish immigrants by background. That's their background. Their church was Swedish immigrants to the United States. Today, they don't speak any Swedish. They have almost nobody who's in their church would know they're Swedish. But there was a time when they had to actually grapple with the fact that we're not going to do worship services in Swedish. But what they did is they said, the best part of our DNA is, we are a church that we understood how to create hospitality and welcome for immigrants. So when Swedish immigrants came to this country, we knew how to give them, to reach them for Jesus and to give them a home they could grow in faith. So that group of Swedish immigrants today is now one of the fastest Spanish language organizations in the United States.
Wonderful. Like,
right? They said Swedish is part of our DNA we can get rid of. But our ability to welcome the immigrant, that's a value we're holding.
Yeah.
And that means we're going to be about Spanish language because that's most of our immigrants in the United States.
That's a great story. But one of the things, too, that you talk about in relation to change, and again, it's probably going to be counterintuitive to folk, is that when you set about the process of change, the first thing you need to do is to decide what's not going to change. This is back to the values thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So talk about that. Deciding first what is so fundamental to who we are that we're not going to change it.
Yeah. So Jim Collins and Jerry Porras, who are two other famous writers, they said once you have determined what will never change, then you have to be prepared to change everything else. And so they believe, and I really do too, is that what starts with is the hard conversation about what's so important to us that we're really not willing to compromise. And if you don't say it out loud, you'll end up with something else. You'll end up with something else that you know, I know churches will say, well, the only thing that's really important here is you give to the budget, or you show up on a Sunday morning. Think about the number of organizations we have now that have picked some ideology to be around. You know, you all vote the same way or do the same thing. What you really want to do is come back to, what is our core ideology? What is the value that we're all committed to? Because it is the central part of our DNA. And that's then from there, we say we're going to retain that no matter what. Because if we lose that, we literally stop being who we are. That's when we start talking about who mm-hmm. shuts down or who, mm-hmm. what I say sometimes, who gets recycled, like what becomes the material that can then maybe God can use to grow something mm-hmm. else. It's mm-hmm. usually when you have lost that core DNA, that core, the sense of values that are clearly your identity. When those things are lost, it's pretty hard to keep them.
Yeah. Probably a little bit about an idea. There's an idea that you probably comes up more than once in the book about, you talk about in the books, disagreeing and committing. Walk through what you're talking about when you talk about that.
Yeah. Well, this was a phrase that was made kind of popular within the tech industry when the innovation was moving so quickly, it would be hard to get a unanimous vote from every smart person in the room. And I was up early this morning writing an email to a church group I'm working with. There's a group of people who've been working for 2 years on making some recommendations to the church about change. And they're stuck right now because they're really trying to get to unanimous vote. Like, we're going to all agree. And I wrote back to the pastor and said, you have really smart, engaged people who are very passionate. They are not going to all agree. And that's okay. If you insist on them agreeing, they will stop being as engaged. So instead, let's have a vigorous conversation where we're safe to disagree, and then we're all going to agree that when this is done, we're going to stack hands and we're going to commit to whatever the group discerns together.
Mm.
And that includes the leader. This is the place where the leader has to say, you know, it's not my job to be the card that wins the hand. It's my job to make sure that the process puts us forward in a direction, and then we protect it. So they talk a lot about disagree, and then commit a new decision.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard thing for many of us who would like there to be unanimous agreement. Yeah. Or those of us who believe that if I can't agree with it, I can't commit to it.
And I guess in an organization, if someone can't commit to a decision, then they need to, you know, look at wearing another jersey next season.
Yeah, exactly. No, and that's exactly it. I just talked to a young man today who was earlier this week, that I'm going to talk to later today.
I was thinking, goodness to me, you've done a lot already. No, and it's 7 o'clock
actually,
in the morning.
I've done a couple of emails this morning, but I'm going to talk to him later today, so he's on my mind. He literally had to leave an organization because he said they went in a direction that was just in disagreement with my values. And I said, then it's great integrity for you to say, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Not stay around and sabotage.
Yeah. I kind of sense that you're probably drawing a little bit from some of Patrick Lencioni's work on this, that whole thing of the five dysfunctions and the ability to trust one another sufficiently to have the hard conversations where thereafter you get this a genuine buy-in on the part of people. Yeah. But if you don't have the hard conversations, so there's not an atmosphere for that, then it's a superficial thing which probably tends to fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. When we talk about the whole book on pushback, which is really that whole book about resistance, but pushing back, is what you realize is pushback actually is what leads to buy-in. You let people disagree, you let them wrestle with it. And then eventually you can come to the place where you can say, okay, what are we committed to? We're going to do. And many of us, if we've been heard, you know, I would say to people, not everybody needs to know, you may not get your way, but we are going to give you your say. You're going to get a chance to get your say, but you may not get your way. We're going to be really clear. Someone has to make a decision. This does. Sometimes it's the council, sometimes it's the person. You may not get your way, but you are going to get your say. And you're not going to be punished for your say. You're going to be valued for it. And then together, we're going to all go the same way together. And if you can't, well, then we'll make decisions.
Mm-hmm. Your vision of leadership and of leaders who, for example, move towards those who are resisting, or like you talk about where there is resistance, moving towards those who are least receptive to your plan. Strikes me that what you're talking about in terms of the quality of a leader, there's a very high degree of vulnerability that's there. And I know that's something you pick up in the Tempered Resilience book. How do leaders cultivate this vulnerability without just being, you know, not how it's the ability to be vulnerable, but yet still have the courage to lead, right?
Yeah, it is. And I always say to people that your capacity to be authentic and vulnerable internally is what's first, which means I try not to fool myself. I have safe places where I can talk about my doubts. I actually want to cultivate a kind of humility where I'm open to learning and relearning. And as Adam Grant says, the best thinkers are rethinkers. They're actually people who change their mind.
Mm-hmm.
But your ability to be transparent and vulnerable externally is a function of the health of your system.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people, I've talked to women and leaders, younger leaders and leaders of color who said to me, you know, Todd, when you, a 60-year-old guy with a PhD, is vulnerable, everybody gets all emotional and inspired. When we do it, they want to give you our job. And so, so there is a wisdom about vulnerability, but it doesn't start with faking it. There's an old, like, fake it till you make it. Yeah. Fake it till you make it is the surest way to end up being to break, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't work. Instead, you start with the vulnerability, the humility, the openness to the other, with the sense that our mission is going to guide us and we're all going to be working together, learning as we go, letting go of things. We're all going to experience loss. We're all going to have to move forward together, and we're going to all experience that transformation as we lean into the mission.
So leaders need to deal with their ego, don't they?
Yeah. Ego and insecurity and the false statements people told us about what leadership looks like or sounds like. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I suppose it plays into the stuff in Tempered Resilience around failure of nerve and failure of heart, the sort of twin dangers, isn't it? And we so easily land in one or other of those rather than finding the place of vulnerability.
Right.
Okay, I'll ask you probably a fairly easy question. We're nearly done, but just what was your favorite? What is your favorite one of these four books?
Such a great question. It kind of depends on the minute when I was writing. Yeah, they're kind of like having four children. You know, I think the thing that I'm very aware of is the books, every one of them, there's a face of a really good leader in my life, like good people that I love, that I kind of wrote them for that person. And then there was a group of people from them. And I would have to say that the one that I come back to the most is this notion about transformation and trust. Investing in transformation. I'm talking about trustworthy leaders, people of integrity and character. And it's so hard to say to them, now that you have spent your whole life being trustworthy, you're going to have to actually get used to disappointing people, because where you're asking them is a kind of transformation that they're going to resist.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the sober moment in the middle of the
problem. Yeah. And that's in the series is the fourth one, although I think you would say you can pick one and
whatever. They're not in any order.
And there are themes that pop up across the books as well, aren't there? Who are they for, really? Who would you say they're for? You've talked about the guy on the plane, but envisage a few different groups of people who might use these books.
Well, it first started because that picture of the person on the plane was actually a woman leader of a nonprofit who I actually had spent some time with in Bangkok. And after we spent some time speaking together, I thought to myself, I thought if there's anything I could give her for the flight back from Los Angeles to Houston, which is where she lived, I'd want her to be able to have something like this. So I think about an NGO leader or a pastor of a church, or one of the books is written around a narrative of a person who runs a small company.
Yes,
because I actually interviewed 10 or 12 different Christians who run small companies and asked them, what's it like for you to try to lead in that context? So the narratives at the front, there's like these fictional narratives that I wrote, are all around some different people. So a pastor, a nonprofit leader, a university seminary president, because I spent 7 years in seminary administration. So there's those, that's all those folks. I think if you're a person who leads anything out of the sense of values, you could be a neighborhood group or your own family or a small business or a large company. I mean, right now we're working with international organizations and large universities. It doesn't matter what the scale is. It's all comes down to, I want my values to make an impact in the world because that's what I believe I'm called to do. And I'm going to do that well in a changing, disruptive world.
Yeah. Okay. And books that would work well with a team. So a team of people sitting down together and talking about a real issue within their organization and using that as a model to develop their thinking. Okay. So due out the four books on how not to waste a crisis, The Mission Always Wins, Leading Through Resistance, Invest in Transformation. And they're all out on the one day. They're all coming out in the middle of August.
They all drop, I think, on August 12th, and right around that time. I know that they're doing pre-sales now, and they're going to be coming out. They all drop on that day.
Okay. Well, folks on your side of the Atlantic, we'll have outlets to be able to get them, and I will see where they're likely to be available here on this side of the Atlantic, and put some links in the program notes, so that people will be able to get the pre-sales done, and maybe a few leadership teams helps to set an agenda for September for them as they get back into things in the new year. Todd, congratulations on the books, for taking the material that I know you love it. You've been working with it for a while and just making it so accessible and so practical for lots of other people. So I hope all that goes well. And thank you for your time today. I think it's probably about breakfast time for you now. You've had your coffee, but time for breakfast. So thank you and God bless you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks to Todd for joining us and thank you for listening. You can check in the program notes and you'll find some links where you can pre-order copies of these books that will be available in August. The podcast will be back in the autumn. Join us then, and in the meantime, I wish you God's blessing over the summer.